Verulam Sports.
Hello again and welcome to Verulam Sport Podcasting, another special Verulam Sports special this week. This is episode 2 of an ongoing series encouraging us all to get active and flourish. And this week, I am very lucky indeed to be joined alongside by a man who has 20 years extensive experience as a trained therapist. He's also a qualified level 3 personal trainer, and Andy Keefe and myself are going to be analysing, discussing and considering the role of physical activity towards our mental health and well-being. So Andy, good afternoon, how you doing?
I'm very well, Tony, thanks, and thank you for inviting me onto your podcast.
Well, Andy, honestly, I'm honoured to be with you. It's a big topic, this one, isn't it? And I'm excited to be unpacking it with you. Lots to be said. First and foremost, again, I really admire the fact that you kind of bring together two worlds with a great insight to the physicality as a trained level 3 personal trainer. And of course, the expertise of our mental framework in your role as a trained therapist. Talk to me, first of all, Andy, about the positive correlation between physical activity and our mental well-being.
Thanks. Yeah, I think one way to think about it is, you know, we're designed to move as humans. That if we don't move, we can't find food, we can't eat, we can't find shelter. So there's always this imperative within us to move, and movement, any form of movement, any form of physical activity. But particularly the more you do it, the more vigorous kind of levels of physical activity will produce hormones in the blood, including such things as serotonin, endorphins, even
the quote-unquote happy hormones, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's kind of a certain evolutionary purpose to encourage us, reward the, you know, activity, and because the brain is there to basically help us survive. So there's any form of movement. I think a lot of people will have appreciate that. Just, you know, going for a run, that lovely thing, you get a bit of a buzz. Just going for a walk, even going for a bike ride, as well as, you know, working out in a gym or doing a HIIT class or something. You always feel that lovely kind of glow afterwards.
Just really quickly to cut in there, I don't know if you were listening, and if you were out there listening to our first episode in this Getting Active and Flourishing series, I was talking to Stuart Clark, the franchise owner of Be Military Fit here in Hertfordshire. And through that, I was inspired to kind of get more active. Goodness knows I'm many things, an armchair pundit included. I'm by no means an athlete, but he's encouraged me to get walking for 30 minutes and run about 3 to 4 times a week. And I've been utterly on that. And I must say, I've lost a few pounds, still got a few to shed, but that's not really the benefit for me. I found just very simply the way that I even see the world. When I'm out on a walk, I kind of see a flower and go, goodness gracious, isn't that beautiful? The way that that's then kind of had the flip effect in my overall working life, for instance, has been very powerful. And this is very early days. Yeah. So I've got to say, I've really experienced this. It's fascinating, isn't it?
Well, I think with walking is a really great example, because a couple of things happen there. One is that obviously, you know, the happy hormones get released. But there's another thing. If you're exercising at that level of intensity, it's like a steady walk, it also affects the way that we think.
Yes.
And it can change our thoughts, can change our thinking patterns, which if you're depressed, you're beset with very negative thinking patterns, or you're anxious, very anxious, worried thinking patterns. The reason it happens is it's an effect called hyperfrontality, is the technical term. There's something about exercising at that level of intensity kind of dissolves the barrier between the left brain and the right brain. So often sort of feelings, because the right brain is non-verbal, ideas and emotional perspectives which might be floating around in the right brain don't often make it into the conscious active, the conscious logical left brain. But that can happen, so we can get different perspectives on a problem if we're walking. And this can often, people often have the, you know, if I'm stuck for ideas and feeling a bit down, going out for a walk, you come back and you're looking at the issue slightly differently, and that can be really helpful.
I believe that the noted evolutionist Darwin is a prime example of somebody who really benefited from this dedication to walking and this amplification of hyperfrontality.
I think there was a particular walk he liked to take in his garden, I think, where he'd go when he was stuck for an idea, and he'd come up with, he'd get a different perspective. But another way of looking at it is that there's simply, obviously, walking involves left-right movement. So you move your left arm, left leg, yes, right leg, left leg, right leg. And that, there's another theory. There's a wonderful book called Walking Your Blues Away by a man called Tom Hartman, who goes
into... Just repeat that again for us, please.
Walking Your Blues Away by Tom Hartman. And his take on this is that it's to do with the because by using left limb, left side, right side, left side, right side, you engage the left and right brain, and again you create this dialogue between the two ways of being, the logical and the emotional and the emotional. But it's also just getting out in nature. This wonderful through just to do this podcast. Stu's got you active. That's fantastic. But when you move on to something else happens when you move on to slightly more vigorous levels of exercise. Because what I'm interested in as a therapist is as well as the boost, happy drugs. I'm interested in how we can use exercise to actually process problems.
Nice.
So at the end of the exercise, there's something has changed, something has shifted, something has been resolved.
That's very important and incredibly powerful. But one of the things that I find very fascinating is this idea of cycle. And obviously I'm committed, and I know it's not going to be an easy ride, to this path of activity, and we'll see where the trajectory takes me. And I hope this is also inspiring others. Sometimes these things are great in theory in the abstract, and they sound wonderful. I think most people get it, but there's the opposite cycle, isn't there? And if you are in a particular situation where either through circumstance or predisposition or who knows what, it's going to be unique to everybody. But if you're in a position where you're in a bit of a negative cycle, then even sometimes getting out of bed can feel a strain. Andy, when people are in that circumstance, if that applies to you at this moment, how can we get over that? Because it's not as simply as much as I will it. You've got to deal with the reality you're facing.
Well, it's a really good question. And I'm really, really interested in people who are in that situation, because one of the real cruel ironies of this is that it's at that the moment when you could often most benefit from exercise. Yes. It's the most difficult to. That's the point where it's hardest to engage with it, and I think, I mean, in my psychotherapy practice, when I meet somebody for the first time, I always ask them about exercise and fitness and movement and physical activity, and quite often people will say something like, "Oh, I used to exercise quite a bit, but like I stopped a few months ago," and then here they are a few months later needing therapy. And I think at that point it can be worth, and some of the work that I do is around helping people find the motivation. And it's extremely difficult when somebody is depressed, but in terms of looking at helping people to sort of engage with what's actually happening, trying to understand the thought processes that are the negative thoughts, that sort of voice that people might have in your head saying, "I'll just give up, don't bother, what's the point? Nobody's interested in you, nothing's going to change." Identifying those thought patterns, changing them, challenging them, trying to find other voices inside somebody that do actually want to recover and get better and move on and progress in life, and creating a dialogue between them so that you can kind of, the two voices can kind of resolve the issue.
The key is congruency, isn't it?
Yeah.
And finding a real, true, powerful steering voice. But once again, it's easier said than done. One thing that I find massively compelling here is that there is this dynamic, isn't there, between the body, and as you rightly say, just evolutionary speaking, we're primed to war, to be motion, and moving beings, but also the mind per se. And one thing that I noticed, just generally speaking, and I know all generalizations are somewhat trite, but it seems to me, to a degree, even prime athletes, elite athletes, have this narrative that is sometimes negative. It seems that our very cerebral cortex is in some way or other designed to, for the most part, encourage, for survival reasons, a sense of comfort and stability, which when amplified could lead to depression, of course. Here's the thing that I would love your take on. How do we consider things more holistically to come past this very inner voices that I think are generally quite negative?
Well, there's several different ways of doing it. I mean, one of which is to look inside, help somebody look inside themselves and find their resources, find their strength. Mm-hmm. Because there'll often be, it's usually that there will have been a time in the past where somebody did have determination and did have drive and did have, and helping bring that part of somebody back to life. That's part of what the therapy is about. And I think it's also, then if you, I suppose, it challenge, as I said, you know, challenging the belief, challenging the negative narrative. But it's often, when I'm talking about voices here, I'm not talking about sort of voices that somebody might hear if they're in the middle of a psychotic episode. I'm just thinking about different parts of the self.
Yes.
And often helping people realize that people can feel as if there's a kind of a massive war going on inside your head and argument depressed. And if you take the approach, help somebody understand that those different parts, the different voices, one that's saying, you know, let's get active, another person that's saying, you know, let's give up, just stay in bed, that they're both coming from a position of good intention toward it. Mm-hmm. And can we help them talk to each other and reach a resolution? And in that way, so it's not about one side winning and not one side sort of being beating. It's about taking, because they're both trying to protect you, both trying to help in different ways. It's about sort of reaching kind of a synthesis of that, like, so basically understanding, okay, what you know, it might be that the voice that's saying don't bother going outside is there because it's actually worried about, you know, safety, what would happen if you are so lucky, and looking, helping people understand, it's really important to understand somebody's environment and their relationship to it. Practical reason, just there's nowhere nice to go nearby. Or it could be something as simple as the fact that somebody tried to go into a gym once and found everybody in there looked incredibly muscled and thin and tanned, you know, toned and fit, and know what they're doing. And it's like, how do I fit into this? That just collapses your self-esteem again.
Do you know what, that's fascinating. And I think one thing that I've got to cling on to and anchor in myself, having begun this program, is a willingness to consistency. And talk to me about that when people are beginning to turn the corner, turn away from negative drivers, shed limiting beliefs, getting back onto a positive frame of mind. But then, as you say, there's this instinct to compare with others, maybe people that we see on TV that we're bombarded with in the media who we're not. How do we kind of achieve that consistency despite the challenges to almost go backwards?
I mean, that's a really important point, because and a lot of the work is about trying to help somebody saying, like, don't think about comparing yourself to the next person, the person next to you who's incredibly fit, has been training for years and can run much faster than you. Think about where you were 2 or 3 weeks ago when you started, and look at the progress you've made. And certainly the work I do with individuals and with groups when I'm teaching. It's all about, like, you against yourself. It's what we're interested in. Don't worry about other people who've been here for years. So helping people and bringing new people into the group. Some work I do, a class I teach on a Sunday morning, is, you know, we've got people that have been very, very fit. But also, it's accessibility and inclusivity. So we, for instance, like every exercise we do, we'll make sure there's 2 or 3 different options. So, like, if you haven't exercised for a while, there's a kind of slightly easier version, you do less reps, but we also want to challenge the people who are fitter, and also fostering within the group a very supportive, you know, welcoming kind of environment. So, like, if I send people off on a run, for instance, the fellow gets back first, I send him back to pick up the person at the back and encourage them and bring them back in, metaphorically put an arm around them and encourage them. So, like, at that way, it's not just me that does this. I mean, that's very much the sort of the outdoor boot camp or BMF world. Stu, you know, I'm sure is talking about this in other episodes. And so it's all about teamwork, creating this sort of this feeling of the group that we're together. You know, we start session together, we finish it together, whatever, and you encourage each other. And that aspect of it's incredibly important too. It's not just the individually what's happening, what you're doing physically. It's the group, it's breaking down isolation, it's being part of a group, it's sharing, it's feeling you belong to something. And I think if you're in that very isolated, cut off, depressed place, just the fact that there's a group of people who are pleased to see you a couple of times, that let's not underestimate that side of it too. It's very important.
It's a really important element here. And I was talking to Billy Schwer, who was a Commonwealth, European, British, and indeed world champion boxer in his own right in his day. Now a very well-known speaker in the personal development world. And he's developed a whole narrative, a whole metaphor using this boxing background, which is dead interesting. And the reason I bring that up now is because it resonated to me with everything you've just talked about with regards to community. He speaks it in a little bit more specific terms, in terms of you need a corner man or woman to support you, that it's not ever going to be possible alone. But this is so crucial, isn't it? Because I think if you try to do these things in isolation, again, you could easily get deterred. And also, perhaps, maybe the flip side of that is easily bored. So again, this community element is so crucial, isn't it?
There's a lot of research evidence for this, that you're much more likely to stick to a program if you're working with a PT, with a personal trainer, or you're a part of a group or a class or something organized, because you're accountable to somebody. Somebody notices if you're there or not. Mm-hmm. And I've been really struck over the last 2 or 3 years I've been training as a PT, with the similarities between the PT client relationship and the therapist client relationship. They're both relational activities. They both stand or fall upon the degree which the sort of professional and client can bond and trust and can communicate. And it really does make a difference if there's somebody there who's looking out for you. But also, I mean, some of the work I do, I combine PT with psychotherapy, and some of my clients who will have each week will have a psychotherapy session and a PT session. Mm-hmm. And in the PT session, sometimes just something, very simple things, if somebody's, because I work very much with trauma and emotion and trapped body rather than the mind. And so sometimes we're dealing with experiences which can't actually be spoken about because they're in the non-part of the brain and in the body. But something really powerful where somebody's very anxious or very frightened or very, very distressed, just walking together with somebody, or running with somebody. Yeah, they're just slow paced, just without even talking, and it can be a very powerful way of mind to mind, unconscious to unconscious, body to body kind of communication. Mirror neurons, it can be very regulating and calming for somebody who's in a state of distress to be somebody who is calm, and you don't, there's not a lot, you and just moving together in that way.
Once again, that strikes me there, of this kind of the way you perceive things, the way that you assist others seems to have this wonderful fluidity between the insights of the advantages discussed of the physicality, the bodied element of our being, and of course the nuances of the psychotherapy side. Here's a question to you. Now, there's still this dichotomy in our thinking in our Western world of mental health, which I think is still stigmatized, although improving, and physical health, which of course is obvious to us all. Like I say, I'm no athlete. You can see an athlete a mile off, and God love them. But here's the thing. Do you think we should consider things just simply well-being, health, embodying both elements of that dichotomy? Are we working towards that, or is that still a naive hope in my head?
Completely. That we should be working with the mind body, or the body mind. In sort of Western Europe, Western world, you should probably know, ever since the time of René Descartes, the French philosopher, and he first person to split the soul and the body.
Yes. Cogito ergo sum.
We have Western medicine has followed those two distinct lines, physical medicine and psychiatric medicine. However, in other parts of the world, I mean, for instance, yoga, in Eastern philosophical traditions, that mind and body is treated much more as one thing. Yoga has been practiced for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And it's based on precisely on this principle that, that moving the body can heal the mind. And I think personally, that the more I've kind of moved personally from a very mind based, mm-hmm. a very psychodynamic psychotherapy training, wonderful training, but a very, very much about thought and mm-hmm. emotional thinking, and to this way I work now, which is much more about looking at what's going on, what people are feeling in the body and moving the body. But it's coming together. I mean, there's all the way along, there's, you know, they're going back decades, there's been body psychotherapy, there's yeah. been dance psychotherapy, there's been sensory motor psychotherapy, mm-hmm. which I'm starting to find out about now, which is a wonderful way of working. And I'm actually working with a sensory motor psychotherapist myself at the moment about...
Andy, just go back on that. Can you just, to the layman, explain exactly what that is all about?
So it's about the idea of working with emotion and feeling and experience in the body, right?
Okay.
So rather than sitting and talking about things, which you would do in standard talking therapy, mm-hmm. The sensory motor psychotherapist and I do this too in my own work. I'm interested in what's happening in their body. What are you feeling? What are you feeling? Where are you feeling it? And often mm-hmm. it might. This whole work would look at, for instance, the idea that we'd look at something like posture, and have the idea and understand that, as sensory motor psychotherapists would understand, that if somebody can learn how to stand up correctly and have the joints and everything loaded properly, the muscles loaded, and the core engaged, and weight distributed evenly mm-hmm. between the joints, that can actually make you feel better. It can relieve your anxiety and help you feel stronger.
Is it an amplification of that one that literally smiling can make us feel better?
Yeah, it's just sitting up. I mean, think, you know, the typically depressed kind of state, you know, somebody's is feeling, if you're feeling down, and we all have these moments where we're feeling down,
of course,
your head falls forward, your shoulders collapse.
It's a slump, isn't it, I suppose?
Which I'm demonstrating now to you, because I'm listening to this, but we can all feel that idea. But if you just sit, if you sort of sit up and you put your shoulders back and you engage your core and you lift your core, you lift your rib cage, you know, you can feel better. And I think that it's changing, it's coming together. And I found this fascinating the other day, where I found, I was reading a book about sensory motor psychotherapy, and I came across, they actually started talking about something called the transverse abdominis muscle, which is like the deepest of the deep core muscles. There's a diagram in a psychotherapy textbook,
yeah.
There's a diagram of the transverse abdominis muscle. And so I think what I'm saying, going back to your question, is that the two sides are coming together. And I think that's going to happen. I hope and expect that will happen more and more over the coming decades.
Coming back to this fascinating aspect, though, is absolutely amazing, because remind me again of that particular, muscle, the diaphragm element, the trans...
Transverse abdominis. So it's the deepest of the deep core muscles. It's the one that everything else builds upon in most movements. It's the one of the spinal stabilizer muscles. And in pretty much any movement the body will take, it everything, all the other muscles build upon that. It's the one that should activate first.
Because at a really primitive level here, what I've found incredibly stimulating about that is just to hear you talk, to, as I can now via Zoom, witness you. Obviously, this is a podcast, it's just auditory. When you made that physical demonstration of the slump posture, and then into a very powerful shoulders back bodily expression, the very way that we breathe changes, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So simply, as simple thing as a deep breath, as cliched as that is, I suspect has an immense potent way to maybe begin this process of reframing and recycling. Can you just elaborate upon that?
Yeah, absolutely. If you often, when we're sort of panicky or anxious, the breath comes up, and people a lot of the time, because people don't think about their breathing, so we're breathing up here. Again, I'm in the top of the chest.
Shallow breathing, is that?
Yeah, shallow breathing, exactly. Shallow and fast. But if you take a few moments to, to breathe into your diaphragm, so just breathe, just put a hand on your stomach and breathe until you feel your tummy rising. hand rising. What's happening is that you're breathing in your diaphragm, which is the muscle that goes sort of along the bottom of the ribs. Mm-hmm. That's pressing because the lungs are filling up. You can also breathe till your rib cage expands, mm-hmm. because your lungs are filling. If you breathe slowly and deeply, like breathe in for three, hold for three, breathe out through the nose, and then you breathe out, long, deep breath out through the mouth. You fill up your lungs, fill up the air spaces. That slows everything down. It slows your heart rate down. It slows, slows the system down and calms you. And it switches on a part of something called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is
just repeat that again, please.
The parasympathetic nervous system. And that's the part of the autonomic nervous system that's responsible for calming the body down.
And this is I love that it contains the word sympathetic, like we have to be sympathetic to ourselves by dint of our being and our engaging with breath.
And just to sort of go off on a bit of a neurology tangent for a moment, because I think this is really important. The other side of that is that its counterpart is something called the sympathetic nervous system.
Okay.
The bit we use when we're getting ready, when we're warming up to go for a workout, it gets the heart pumping, gets the muscles, blood into the muscles, gets fluid into the joints. That's also the part of the body that the nervous system that is used by the brain when our fight or flight mechanism is triggered during a trauma, right? Because the amygdala, the brain's alarm system, tells the body to literally get ready to literally fight the danger or run away from it. Fight or flight, that's what it's all about, or freeze, that's what it is, the third option. And so it's incredibly important. And when we get re-traumatized, when we get triggered, when someone's condition develops into post-traumatic stress disorder, for instance, when we get triggered, something reminds the brain, the amygdala, the alarm system, of the original incident. It thinks it's happening again because it doesn't have a sense of time or place, and it uses the sympathetic nervous system again, pumps out loads of stress hormones, adrenaline, cortisol, etc., gets the body, and this is what this sort of agitation, the heart gets pumping, the breathlessness, it all happens again. It's part of the traumatic response, physical response to trauma. So we use, and again, yogis have known this for thousands of years. This is nothing new, I'm telling you here. This has been known for literally millennia. That you sit when you're agitated like that, or when you're anxious, or when you're frightened, you sit and you breathe deeply. You slow your breathing down. You slow the body down. You slow the heart down. You slow the lungs down, and it calms you down, and it literally calms the brain. It goes up through something called the vagal nerve, goes up the amygdala, where all this is causing the issue, the alarm system, the brain. It's in the sort of deep limbic brain.
Is that sort of what they refer to as the reptilian element of our mind?
Yeah, absolutely, the reptilian brain. And the best way to calm that, if that part of the brain is switched on and agitated, the best way to calm it is through breathing or through movement. Because if you remember a situation where if you've been agitated or upset or anxious about it, and somebody just says, "Oh, just calm down." No matter how annoying that is when somebody tells
you. It's crazy, isn't it? They might as well say, just beat Usain Bolt over 100 meters.
No, the reason that's so annoying is because the bit of your brain that hears the words, just calm down, isn't the bit that's anxious.
Yeah.
And the two bits can't communicate with each other. So that's a long-winded explanation. But so we can get to the anxious bit of the brain through slowing our breathing down. And particularly the two bits important to it, three bits. The slowing it down, breathing deep into the diaphragm, deep into the rib, and then the out breath. That's the bit that really switches on the press.
And is it out through the nostrils?
Through the mouth.
Through the mouth.
Yeah. And sort of breathe it so you can hear your breath coming out. That's the bit. I mean, there's all sorts of different techniques, but that's the way that I do it.
I think that's incredibly important. I'm very grateful for this insight. I really hope you listening can just take on board some of these fantastic and I think quite simple tips here. Now, Andy, one thing I do need to ask you is, because I'm conscious, of course, as I've already said, that an awful lot of this might sound good, an awful lot of it might resonate, but again, it's got to be applied, it's got to be practiced, it's got to be committed to. But here's the thing. Life is stressful, always has been. My mama never sat me down on her knee and looked me in the eye and said, "Tony, life's a doddle." Okay. I'm sure people listening understand that. They've probably experienced highs, lows, and all the muddy in the middle. But here's the thing. We are living in a very curious age at this time, aren't we, with COVID and all of that. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a more acute sense of anxiety in people of late? And if indeed that is the case, how can we recultivate and flip and work within the global context, which of course, as powerful as everybody is, athletes, boxers, whatever you are, and everybody else in between, ain't none of us controlling the global context, are we?
No. I mean, there's been a lot of distress and worry and anxiety and trauma and loss and depression in mm-hmm. the world for the last year. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have come to talk to me about it in my psychotherapy practice. And I think this stage we are finally seem to be in, this stage of getting back to, you know, coming out of it, the vaccine's working, etc. People, you know, infection, you know, the lockdown seems to be easing. Mm-hmm. I think we're now presented with, well, what happens when life goes back to normal? I think a lot of people are finding that actually quite anxiety making. Mm-hmm. To suddenly relearn to socialize again, to go mm-hmm. back into the world. And so, plus also, I think a lot of people are recovering from COVID.
Of course.
And I think fitness has a big role to play in recovery from COVID. Mm-hmm. Lucky enough to do a course in this weeks ago, just because I know people are going to be presenting with and I wanted to know what I'm talking about when I start engaging. But I think if you look at what COVID does, it's a respiratory yep. disease. Attacks your cardiac condition, it attacks the your breathing, it attacks your lungs, it mm-hmm. attacks your heart, it also leaves you quite weak physically. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, fitness has a big role to play in it, but also has a big role in terms of the actual physical recovery, but also in terms of the psychological recovery and rebuilding confidence, mm-hmm. you know, reducing the anxiety, just getting out. It can be a good way. I think there's something, again, coming back to just going for a walk, there's something about just getting out into your neighborhood, getting out into your surroundings and realizing that it's safe. You can exist in it, you can act in it, you can work, live in it. And so I think exercise is going to have a big role in this. There's also, as you know, there does seem to be some kind of link between obesity and COVID and the impact that COVID has on you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's good that people are encouraged to be to get fit, get into a bit of shape. I don't know if at this point it suddenly makes me think of some of the issues with exercise, because obviously you can overdo it, right? And it can be a feature over exercising. Much can be a feature of eating disorders.
Again, it comes back, doesn't it, to this need to consider your role, your life, however you are, whatever context you're going through, as a holistic perspective, not to kind of zone in too much on any one element, but just to cultivate an overall, again, it's a bit cliched, but life, work, family, simply eating and being kind of existence. Now, Andy, coming back though to the context of the COVID, and you've explained brilliantly the powerful role that exercise will play. Mm-hmm. But one thing I'm always going to revert back to in myself is that I am a naive idealist until my dying day. And I would take a naive stance on everything you've explained there about the proliferation of people visiting you, this mm-hmm. sense of acute anxiety that many may well still be experiencing. Because here's my naive stance on it, that indicates to me that there is at least a kind of movement away from perhaps an overly British stoicism and stiff upper lippedness and a more open embracement of mindfulness, so to speak. And I know, again, that's become a little bit of a cheesy phrase, but that's my positive take on it. Would I be naive in that, or is there something to be said for that perspective?
I think there's much more openness now. To talking about mental illness and just accepting that mental ill health is something we all struggle with, and I think particularly younger people, it's a generational thing as well.
Yep.
I'm meeting a lot of people in their 20s and early 30s, mm-hmm. and I'm saying sadly because these people, you know, so much going for them, and yeah. wonderful life. But there's a lot of anxiety.
But sometimes we do need that objective voice to remind us of exactly what we do have going for us, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's helping people enjoy things because there can be all sorts of different reasons why somebody might not be fully able to engage and enjoy life. But, you know, people who had difficult childhoods, people who've been living through abusive relationships, for instance, living with chronic anxiety of various forms. And I think there's much, but even so, but then, it's, you know, I do have people in their clients in their late 70s as well, and all ages in between. So, and I think there's more willingness, I think, now for people to talk about the fact that maybe they have been struggling with something. And the statistics have consistently shown that like one in four people will have depression at some point in their life. That stat has been steady for many years.
The extrapolation of that, which always makes me saddened, is that I think suicide is the biggest killer of certainly under 40s, I believe, of anything else.
Yeah. And I think particularly amongst men, with young men, it's one of, or if not the biggest killer. The real tragedy is that often it's avoidable. But I think when people get into that position of thinking this is completely hopeless, there's no way out of it. If anybody's in that position now who's listening to this, you know, reach out and ask for help. Through your GP, through the Samaritans, through the NHS, etc., through local therapists, because there really is talk. Therapy is an incredibly powerful tool.
Yeah,
it's an incredibly powerful tool as well. If you put the two things together, it really can help you work through depression. Because I think part of the danger about, we think of depression as being mainly about sadness, which is crushing, really kind of powerful to, experience of sadness. But it's also the negative thoughts. It's a lack of energy. It's that sort of thought about what's the point? Just give up. Nobody, I see, it's nothing's going to change. And one of the things that therapy can do is help you understand that those are just thoughts. Different perspective on this. That, you know, there's different ways of thinking about things. There's different, and I think through talking about it, standard talking therapies, etc., it really can help to, and also understanding where the depression comes from and working through some of the difficult experiences of early life.
Andy, just to cut in here, again, always value your brilliant guidance here. I'd like to get this now laser focused in on one of your areas of specialism. If you could just talk to me a little bit about what solution focused therapy is and how it could well help somebody who perhaps right now is feeling these acute negative thoughts.
Yeah, well, solution focused therapy takes the view that actually, rather than just simply focusing on the problem, you go the other way and think, well, how can we solve this? Right. So you might, rather than getting focused on other forms of psychotherapy, you know, we go back to the roots of the problem, back into the past. But a solution focused therapy perhaps might say, okay, you say you're feeling hopeless and awful all the time, but are there any moments in the week when you don't feel hopeless? And you kind of, when's that? Maybe when I'm out. Okay, well, and when else? And you kind of amplify, you try and build up the. Also, they've got this, you help, there's a technique called the miracle question, which is about helping somebody say, rather than thinking about focusing on, because the energy changes when you start to get someone thinking about how things could be different. So you get somebody to imagine, okay, it's a very simple technique, which is to imagine that you wake up in the morning and a miracle's taken place overnight and the whatever problem you're wrestling with at the minute has been solved. Let's explore what you'd notice, what would be the first thing that you'd see that would tell you that the problem has changed or there's been a change.
And again, just do you notice that everybody's answer to that will reflect their narrative? So I guess some people would talk in terms of maybe heaviness lifting. Maybe other people might talk in terms of a light bulb, an enlightening moment. It must be quite a fascinating way people kind of express this and answer that miracle question.
Well, yeah, it can. I mean, often it might be so that somebody's struggling with a problem in a relationship or within their family, and you can express how the relationship would be different, right? And then you go through this process. You use a scale. You simply say, all right, so imagine a scale of 0 to 10. 10 is the miracle's taken place, and everything's fine. 0 is the worst things have ever been. Mm-hmm. Where are you now on that scale? Mm-hmm. And so I'm at a one, okay, and then you start thinking, well, what does two look like, and how do we get to two? You start to very simple steps like that, and you engage somebody thinking about change. Now, there's arguments for against working this way, but it certainly is true, is that the energy changes when you get somebody often to start thinking about how things, just thinking about the fact that things are different. And then that opens up all sorts of different ways. There are also occasions where actually the solution, what you do have to go down into the depths of the past and work through difficult experiences from there and get through that. But I think I very much the way I mainly work now is using something called eye movement desensitization reprocessing, or EMDR.
Just explain that, express that again, that phrase. I think it's quite a compelling one, because again, visually, it connects to how we think and remember, just from my limited NLP understanding.
Yeah, it's a very similar idea to eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's a therapy that was developed in the 1980s by Francine Shapiro, an American psychologist. And she and it's designed for working with trauma. And it's not a talking therapy, but it kind of uses eye movements, uses tapping, uses left, right direction.
Okay.
Motion, we call it.
And again, to the layman, that is all to do with anchoring emotion, is it? Or reframing?
It's about giving the brain's natural memory processing mechanism a kickstart.
Okay.
Because what happens in trauma is that so much information comes in during a traumatic incident that it gets the memory processing part of the brain gets overwhelmed, and things can't be filed away and stored away in the brain's library, like the hippocampus.
Okay, yeah.
Stuck in the amygdala, as I was talking about earlier, which doesn't have a sense of time or place. If a memory is in the library, in the hippocampus, you can remember it, say, well, it was horrible, that was awful, but it happened 5 years ago.
Right? Yeah.
In amygdala, the amygdala thinks it's happening again as soon as you're reminded of it. And the movement, the eye movement work that we do, moves the memory from the amygdala into the hippocampus. And it's also a bit like, another way to think about it, it's a bit like, even though there's one part of you, you've been through some traumatic experience, and there's one part of you that knows that it's over and you're safe, and it's April 2021, and the sun's shining okay, but it's as if there's another part of you thinks you're still being attacked or you're still violated.
Is there ever a resistance whereby somebody's identity is tied up with this sense of the past and the trauma, or even just less than traumatic in a more kind of normative context, whereby I don't want to be kind of tarnishing or just too traumatic, but there is, I feel, sometimes a tendency to embrace a slightly woe is me identity.
I think, and that sometimes there's a bit interesting to debate in our field about the difference between a victim and a survivor.
Okay.
Get away from the language of the victim.
Sure.
Talking about survivors of sexual abuse, survivors of
trauma. Of course.
And emphasizing the fact that if you've survived, if you've come through and things like that, you're incredibly tough, and helping somebody find their toughness, find their strength, find their resilience. But what can happen also is that one of the things we're interested in with EMDR is we'll look at sort of certain images, certain of the memories, but we'll look at the negative thoughts you have about yourself when you put yourself back in that moment, because often these thoughts that people have, that I'm useless.
Yeah.
No one loves, I'm unlovable, I'm broken.
And again, just to be clear, those emotions you can notice by dint of the eye motion when they are recalling that type of event? Is that how it is managed?
It's what we do as part of the processing. So we look at the negative thoughts you have in relation to the traumatic memory. And then we try and think of, okay, what would you like to think about yourself instead? Okay. It could be something like, I'm safe, I've survived, I can handle this, I'm lovable. We gradually replace the negative thoughts with the positive thoughts. So that when what you're left with at the end is that the image has faded, has less of an emotional impact on you. And also when you put yourself in that moment, you think, okay, I survived that, I'm safe, I'm strong, rather than I'm weak and I'm broken. And the movement, the memories move. So then when you are reminded of it, you can remember it without reliving it. And that's an incredible relief. And so, yeah, That's EMDR in,
in a nutshell. Look, that is so stimulating to me. I'll tell you what, I could unpack that with you forever and a day. But Andy, for just now, it's been an honor and a privilege to enjoy your company. I'm sure an awful lot of this will resonate with an awful lot of people. As Andy's already said, if you are suffering at this time, I know an awful lot of us are, then please do not be ashamed to seek support. But if you are just intrigued by some of the fascinating aspects of this conversation that we've really only had the moment to see the tip of the iceberg about, Andy, where can we go for more information?
Well, my website is eastlondonandcitypsychotherapist.com. And that's where I work about both my therapy and my fitness work. But also, anyone lives anywhere in East London or Wanstead, you want to look at wanstedflatsfitness.com. That's the group I work with on Sunday mornings. And, but also on a Wednesday morning, I run a circuits and mindfulness sessions, a fitness for mental health session online, which is, you know, details of how to join that can be found by contacting me. Which is a combination of a circuit class for the body,
yes,
and then relaxation and mindfulness at the end. And it's a really sort of powerful way to just
integral being.
Yeah. And it's all about very much about helping people notice what they're feeling, their emotions they're feeling at the beginning of the class, and where you're feeling that in the body, and what happens. Emotion and your body as you warm up and you work out, and then as we relax at the end, we stretch, and then we do the mindfulness, and we focus very much on what's been released, what's been let go of, and that coming to a lovely sense of relaxed stillness. That's on Sunday Wednesday morning, but also individuals, as I said, psychotherapy and sessions too. That's how I work.
All sounds incredibly positive. I'm going to get my shoes on and go and carry on my program of walking. Fantastic. Andy, once again, in closing, just remind us of those websites, please.
So it's eastlondonandcitypsychotherapist.com, and the and is and, A-N-D, and also wanstedflatsfitness.com if you're anywhere near the Wanstead area. Fantastic. Boot camps on Tuesdays, Thursday evening, 7:30, and Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock, and a postnatal fitness class at 9 o'clock in the morning, which I run on a Sunday morning, which is fantastic fun as well.
Hey, well, listen, it's been fantastic fun for me to talk to you. I think you're going to help an awful lot of people, and I know you're going to continue doing that professionally. Thank you for your time and company today, Andy, and I'd like to bid you, in closing, all the absolute best. Keep well, keep safe. Thanks for your time just now.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.